The nomadic existence of the Romani intrigues him. His life of comfort and knowing his place in the world, his education and life experiences, seem mundane and predictable compared to the travels and struggles endured by the people he now finds himself living with. There is one woman he has often noticed on her own. She appears to have no children or family, no one who engages with her or shows her affection. Often, she is just an extra pair of hands for a mother struggling with too many children. She looks like she's in her 50s, though Lale has learned that the Romani men and women often look older than their years. One evening, both of them having assisted with getting the children to sleep, Lale follows her outside.
"Thank you for your help tonight," he begins.
She gives him a thin smile and sits on a pile of bricks to rest.
"I've been putting children to bed since I was a baby, myself. I could do it with my eyes closed."
Lale sits beside her.
"I don't doubt it. But you don't seem to have any family here."
She shakes her head sadly.
"My husband and son died of typhus. It's only me now. Nadia."
"I'm so sorry, Nadia. I'd like to hear about them. My name is Lale." That evening, Lale and Nadia converse long into the night. Lale does most of the talking, with Nadia preferring to listen. He tells her of his family back in Slovakia, and of his love for Gita. He discovers she is only 41 years old. Her son had been 6 when he died 3 years ago, 2 days before his father.
When Lale asks for her opinion, he finds Nadia's answers similar to those his mother would give.
Is it this that draws him to her? That makes him want to protect her the way he wants to protect Gita? He finds himself sinking into an acute homesickness. He can't ignore his fears about the future. Dark thoughts he has kept at bay about his family and their safety consume him. If he can't help them, then he will do what he can for this woman in front of him.
A few days later, as he arrives back, a young boy toddles up to him. Lale sweeps him up in his arms.
The boy's weight and smell remind him of the young nephew he said goodbye to over a year ago. Overcome with emotion,
Lale places the child back down and hurries inside. For once, none of the children follow him. Something tells them to keep their distance.
Lying on his bed, he thinks back to the last time he was with his family. The farewell at the train station that would take him to Prague. His mother had helped him pack his suitcase. In between wiping away tears, she kept taking out clothes he packed and putting in books for comfort and a reminder of home, wherever you end up.
As they stood on the platform, with Lale about to board the train, he saw tears in his father's eyes for the first time.
He had expected them from everyone else, but not from his strong, dependable father. From his carriage window, he saw his father being helped away by his brother and sister. His mother ran the length of the platform, her arms outstretched, trying desperately to reach out to her baby boy. His two young nephews, oblivious to their changing world, ran innocently beside the train, playing chase with it.
Clutching his suitcase containing only clothes and the few books he'd allowed his mother to pack, Lale leaned his head against the window and sobbed.
He had been so caught up in the emotion of his family that he hadn't registered his own devastating loss.
Chiding himself for letting his situation get to him, Lale goes back outside and chases the children around, letting them catch and climb all over him.
"Who needs trees when you have a tetoviera to hang from?" That evening, he joins a group of men sitting outside. They share memories and stories of family life, captivated by the differences and similarities between their cultures. With the emotion of the day still running high, he says,
"You know, in another life, I would have nothing to do with you.
I would probably turn away from you or cross the street if I saw you walking towards me. There is silence for several moments before one of the men pipes up.
Hey, Petoviera, in another life we would have nothing to do with you either. We would cross the street first.
The laughter that follows brings one of the women outside to tell them to be quiet. They will wake the children and then there will be trouble.
The men retreat inside, duly chastened. Lale lingers. He's not tired enough to sleep. He senses Nadia's presence and turns to see her standing in the doorway.
Join me, he says. Nadia sits beside him, staring off into the night. He studies her face in profile. She is quite beautiful. Her unshaven brown hair cascades down her shoulders and blows in the slight breeze around her face, so that she spends a good deal of time tucking it back behind her ears. A gesture so familiar to him. A gesture his mother made all day, every day, as wayward strands escaped from her tight bun or from under the scarf that hid it. Nadia speaks with the quietest natural voice he has ever heard. She's not whispering. This is her voice.
Lale finally works out what it is about her voice that saddens him. It is emotionless. Whether relaying stories of happy times with her family or the tragedy of being here, there is no change in tone.
What does your name mean? He asks.
Hope. It means hope.
Nadia stands.
Good night, she says.
She is gone before Lale can reply.
Chapter 11, May 1943.
Lale and Leon's daily lives are still being dictated by the arrival of transports from across Europe.
As spring becomes summer, they do not stop coming. Today the pair are working with long rows of female prisoners. The selection process is taking place a small distance away. They are too busy to pay attention to it. An arm and a piece of paper appear before them, and they do their job, over and again. These prisoners are unusually quiet, perhaps sensing evil in the air.
Lale suddenly hears someone break into whistling. Tune is familiar. Perhaps an opera. The whistling grows louder, and Lale glances in its direction. A man in a white coat is walking their way. Lale puts his head down, attempting to keep to the rhythm of his job. Don't look at faces. He takes the paper, makes the number the way he has 1,000 times before. The whistling stops. The doctor now stands beside Lale, emitting a pungent smell of disinfectant. Leaning over, he inspects Lale's work and takes the arm he is midway through tattooing. He must be satisfied because he moves on as quickly as he arrived, bastardizing another melody. Lale looks up at Leon, who has turned pale. Baretsky materializes beside them.
What do you think of our new doctor?
Didn't really introduce himself,
murmurs Lale.
Baretsky laughs.
This is one doctor you don't want to be introduced to, trust me. I'm scared of him. The guy's a creep.
Do you know what he is called?
Mengele. Herr Dr. Josef Mengele. You should remember that name, Tetoviera.
What was he doing at the selection?
Herr Doctor has made it known that he will be at many of the selections, as he is looking for particular patients.
I take it being sick is not a criterion for him.
Baretsky doubles over laughing.
You can be so funny sometimes, Tetoviera.
Lale goes back to work. A little while later, he hears the whistling start up behind him, and the sound shoots such a shock of fear through his body that he slips and stabs the young woman he is tattooing. she cries out. Lale wipes the blood that trickles down her arm. Mengele steps closer.
Something wrong, Tetoviera? You are the Tetoviera, are you not?
Mengele asks.
His voice sends chills down Lale's spine.
Sir, I mean, yes, sir. I am the Tetoviera, Herr Doctor,
Lale stammers.
Mengele, beside him now, stares him down, his eyes black as coal, devoid of compassion. A strange smile stretches across his face. Then he moves on.
Baretsky approaches and punches Lale hard on the arm.
Having a hard day, Tetoviera? Perhaps you would like to take a break and clear the latrines instead.
That night, Lale tries to wash the dried blood from his shirt with water from a puddle. He partially succeeds, but then decides a stain will be an appropriate reminder of the day he met Mengele. A doctor, Lale suspects, who will cause more pain than he eases, whose very existence threatens in ways Lale doesn't want to contemplate. Yes, the stain must remain to remind Lale of the new danger that has entered his life. He must always be wary of this man whose soul is colder than his scalpel. The next day, Lale and Leon find themselves at Auschwitz again to number young women. The whistling doctor is present. He stands before the parade of girls, deciding their fate with a flick of his hand. Right, left, right. Right, left, left. Lale can't see any logic to the decisions. They are all in the prime of their lives, fit and healthy. He sees Mengele watching him, being watched. Lale can't take his eyes away as Mengele grabs the next girl's face in his big hands, twists it back and forward, up and down, and opens her mouth. And then with a slap to the face, he pushes her to the left. Rejected. Lale stares him down. Mengele calls an SS officer over and speaks to him. The officer looks over at Lale and begins walking in his direction. Shit.
What do you want? He demands with more confidence than he feels. Shut up, Tetoviera. The SS officer turns to Leon. Leave your things and come with me.
Wait a minute. You can't take him. Can't you see the number of people still to be done? Lale asks, now terrified on his young assistant's behalf.
Then you'd better get on with your work, or you will be here all night, Tetoviera, and her doctor won't like that.
Leave him, please. Let us get on with our work. I'm sorry if I've done anything to upset her doctor, Lale says. The officer points his rifle at Lale.
Do you want to come too, Tetoviera?
Leon says, I'll go. It's okay, Lale. I'll be back as soon as I can. I'm sorry, Leon. Lale can no longer look at his friend. It's all right. I'll be all right. Get back to work. Leon is marched off. That evening, Lale, greatly distressed, trudges alone, head down, back to Birkenau.
Something just off the track catches his eye. A flash of color. A flower. A single flower waving in the breeze. Blood-red petals around a jet-black middle. He looks for others, but there are none. Still, it is a flower. And he wonders again about the next time he could give flowers to someone he cares for. Images of Gita and his mother come to him. The two women he loves the most, floating just out of reach. Grief comes in waves, threatening to drown him.
Will the two ever meet? Will the younger learn from the older? Will Mama welcome and love Gita as I do?
He had learned and practiced the art of flirting on his mother. Though he was fairly sure she didn't realize what he was doing, he knew. He knew what he was doing. He learned what worked on her and what didn't,
and he quickly worked out what was appropriate and inappropriate behavior between a man and a woman. He suspected all young men embarked on this learning process with their mothers, though he often wondered if they consciously realized it. He had brought it up with several of his friends who had reacted with shock, claiming they did no such thing.
When he questioned them further about whether they got away with more from their mother than their father, they all admitted to behaviors that could be construed as flirting. They thought they were just getting around Mum because she was easier than Dad. Lale knew exactly what he was doing. Lale's emotional connection to his mother had shaped the way he related to girls and women.
He was attracted to all women, not just physically, but emotionally. He loved talking to them. He loved making them feel good about themselves. To him, all women were beautiful, and he believed there was no harm in telling them so.
His mother, and also his sister, subliminally taught Lale what it was a woman wanted from a man, and so far he had spent his life trying to live up to these lessons.
Be attentive, Lale. Remember the small things, and the big things will work themselves out.
He heard his mother's sweet voice.
He bends and gently picks the short stem.
He will find a way to give it to Gita tomorrow. Back in his room, Lale carefully places the precious flower beside his bed before falling into a dreamless sleep. But the next morning when he wakes, the petals from his flower have separated and lie curled up beside the black center.
Death alone persists in this place. Chapter 12.
Lale doesn't want to look at the flower anymore, so he leaves his block to throw it away. Beretsky is there, but Lale ignores him, preferring to head back inside and into his room. Beretsky follows him and leans in the doorway. He studies the distraught-looking Lale. Lale is aware that he sits on a lumpy fortune of gems, currency, sausage, and chocolate. He grabs his bag and pushes past Beretsky, forcing him to turn and follow him outside.
Wait up, Tetoviera. I need to talk to you.
Lale stops.
I have a request for you.
Lale remains silent, looking at a point beyond Beretsky's shoulder.
My fellow officers and I, in need of some entertainment. And as the weather is improving, we were thinking of a game of football. What do you think?
I'm sure it would be fun for you.
Yes, indeed.
Beretsky plays the game and waits.
Lale eventually blinks. How can I help you?
Well, now that you've asked, Tetoviera, we need you to find 11 prisoners to take on a team of SS in a friendly match.
Lale considers laughing, but keeps his gaze at the point over Beretsky's shoulder. He thinks long and hard about his reply to this bizarre request.
What? No substitutes?
No substitutes.
Sure. Why not? Where did that come from? There are a million other things I could say, like, fuck off.
Good. Great. Get your team together and we'll meet in the compound in 2 days' time, Sunday. Oh, and we'll bring the ball.
Laughing loudly, Beretsky walks off.
By the way, Tetoviera, you can have the day off. There are no transports today.
Lale spends part of the day sorting his treasure into small bundles. Food for the Romani and the boys in Block 7, and of course Gita and her friends.
Gems and currency sorted by type. The process is surreal. Diamonds with diamonds, rubies with rubies, dollars with dollars, and even a stack of currency as never seen before, bearing the words South African Reserve Bank and Suid-Afrikaans. He has no idea of its value or how it found its way into Birkenau. Taking several gems, he goes looking for Victor and Yuri to make the day's purchases. He then plays for a while with the boys from his block as he tries to formulate what he will say to the men in Block 7 upon their return from work.
In the evening, Lale is surrounded by dozens of men looking at him incredulously.
"You have got to be fucking kidding," one of them says.
"No,"
Lale replies.
"You want us to play football with the fucking SS?"
"Yes, this coming Sunday."
"Well, I'm not going to do it. You can't make me,"
the same person replies. From the back of the group, a voice calls out,
"I'll play. I've played a little."
A small man pushes his way through the gathered men and stands in front of Lale.
"I'm Joel."
"Thanks, Joel. Welcome to the team. I need another 9 of you. What have you got to lose? This is your one chance to get a little physical with the bastards and get away with it.
I know a guy in Block 15 who played in the Hungarian national team. I'll ask him if you like,"
another prisoner pipes up. "What about you?"
Lale asks.
"Yeah, sure. I'm Joel too. I'll ask around and see who I can get. Is there any chance we can have a practice before Sunday? Plays football and has a sense of humour. I like this guy. I'll be back tomorrow night to see how you've done. Thanks, Big Joel."
Lale looks over at the other Joel.
"No offence."
"None taken,"
Little Joel replies.
Lale produces bread and sausage from his bag and lays it upon a nearby bunk.
As he leaves, he watches two of the men share out the food. Each recipient breaks their portion into bite-sized pieces and hands them round. No pushing, no fighting. An orderly distribution of life-saving nourishment. He overhears one man say,
"Here, Big Joel, you have mine. You'll need your energy."
Lale smiles.
A day that started badly is ending with a magnanimous gesture from a starving man.
The day of the game arrives. Lale wanders into the main compound to see SS painting a white line into what is far from an oblong shape.
He hears his name being called and finds his team gathered together. He joins the men.
"Hey, Lale, I've got 14 players counting you and me. A couple in reserve if some of us fall over,"
Big Joel tells him proudly.
"Sorry, I was told no substitutes. Just one team. Choose the fittest." The men look at each other. Three hands rise, and those volunteering to take no part walk away.
Lale watches as several of the men stretch and jump up and down in the manner of a professional warm-up.
"Some of these guys look like they know what they're doing," Lale mutters to Little Joel.
"They should. 6 of them have played semi-professionally."
"You're kidding."
"Nope. We're going to kick their asses."
"Little Joel, you can't. We can't win. I guess I didn't make myself clear."
"You said get a team together. And I did."
"Yeah. But we can't win. We can't do anything to humiliate them. We mustn't tempt them to open fire on everyone. Look around you." Little Joel sees the hundreds of prisoners gathered. There is an air of excitement in the camp as they push and shove for a vantage point around the perimeter of the painted playing area. He sighs.
"I'll tell the others."
Lale scans the crowd for one face only. Geeta stands with her friends and waves to him furtively.
He waves back, wanting desperately to run to her, sweep her up in his arms and disappear behind the administration building. He hears loud banging and turns to see several SS pounding large poles into the ground at each end to make goalposts. Beretsky approaches him.
"Come with me."
At one end of the field, the crowd of prisoners parts as the SS team enters. None of them are in uniform. Several wear clothing that will make playing a game of football much easier. Shorts, singlets.
Behind the team, a heavily guarded commandant, Schwarzhuber, and Lale's boss, Hausdeck, approached Lale and Boretsky.
"This is the captain of the prisoner team, the Tetoviera."
Boretsky introduces Lale to Schwarzhuber.
"Tetoviera?" He turns to one of his guards. "Have we got something we can play for?"
A senior SS takes a cup from a soldier beside him and shows it to his commandant.
"We have this. It will make a more than suitable trophy. The inscription says 1930 World Cup. I believe the winners were France."
He shows the trophy to Lale.
"What do you think?"
Before Lale can respond, Schwarzhuber takes the trophy and holds it aloft for everyone to see.
The SS cheer.
"Start the game, and may the best team win."
As Lale jogs back to his team, he mutters, "May the best team live to see the sun come up tomorrow." Lale joins his team and they gather in the middle of the field. The spectators cheer.
The referee kicks the ball towards the SS team, and it's game on. 10 minutes into the game, the prisoners have scored 2-0.
While Lale enjoys the goals, common sense prevails when he looks at the angry faces of the SS.
He subtly lets his players know to slow it down for the remainder of the half. They have had their moments of glory, and it is now time to let the SS into the game. The half ends 2-2. While the SS are given drinks during the short break,
Lale and his team gather to discuss tactics. Eventually, Lale impresses on them that they cannot win this game.
It is agreed that to help boost morale for the watching prisoners, 2 more goals can be scored, as long as they lose by 1 goal in the end. As the second half begins, ash rains down on players and spectators. The crematoria are in action, and this core task of Birkenau has not been interrupted by sport. Another goal goes in for the prisoners, and another for the SS. As their appallingly inadequate diet begins to tell, the prisoners tire. The SS score 2 further goals. The prisoners don't need to throw the game. They simply can't compete any longer. With the SS 2 up, the referee blows his whistle for full time. Schwarzhuber makes his way onto the field and presents the trophy to the SS captain, who raises it aloft to muted cheers from the guards and officers present.
As the SS make their way back to their barracks to celebrate, Hausdeck walks past Lale.
"Well played, Tetoviera."
Lale gathers his team and tells them what a great job they've done.
The crowd has begun to disperse. He looks around to find Gita, who hasn't moved from her spot. He jogs over to her and takes her by the hand. They move through the other prisoners towards the administration block.
As Gita drops to the ground behind the building, Lale looks around for prying eyes.
Satisfied, he sits beside her. He watches Gita as she runs her fingers through the grass, examining it intently.
"What are you doing? Looking for 4-leaf clover? You'd be surprised by how many there are here."
Lale smiles, charmed.
"You're kidding." "No. I've found several. Ivana finds them all the time. You look shocked."
"I am. You're the girl who doesn't believe she'll get out of here. Yet you're looking for good luck charms." "They're not for me. It's true, I don't believe in such things."
"For who, then?"
"Do you know how superstitious the SS are?
If we find a 4-leaf clover, we treasure it. It's like currency for us."
"I don't understand."
"Whenever we are in danger from the SS, we hand it over and sometimes it stops them from hitting us. If we take one to a mealtime, we might even get extra rations."
Lale gently strokes her face. That he cannot protect the girl he loves anguishes him greatly. Gita leans back down and continues her search, grabbing a handful of grass She throws it at Lale with a smile.
He grins back. Playfully, he nudges her over, and she lies on her back. Leaning over her, he plucks a handful of grass and slowly lets it sprinkle down onto her face. She blows it away. Another handful of grass goes onto her neck and the top of her chest. She leaves it there. He undoes the top button on her shirt, drops more grass, and watches it disappear down her cleavage.
"May I kiss you?" he asks. "Why would you want to? I haven't brushed my teeth for I don't know how long."
"Me neither. So I guess we cancel each other out." Geeta answers him by raising her head towards his. Their previous fleeting kiss ignited a year's worth of longing. Pent-up passions collide as they explore each other now. They want, they need more of each other. The moment is broken by the sound of a barking dog nearby.
They know the animal must have a handler attached to it. Lale stands and pulls Geeta up into his arms. One last kiss before they run back to the safety of the compound and a crowd they can melt into.
In the women's camp, they spot Dana, Ivana, and Silka and begin walking towards them.
Lale notices Silka's pallor. "Is Silka all right?" Lale asks. "She doesn't look well."
"She's as well as can be expected, under the circumstances."
"Is she sick? Do you need medicine?"
"No, she's not sick. You're better off not knowing."
As they near the girls, Lale leans into Geeta, whispering,
"Tell me. Maybe I can help."
"Not this time, my love."
Geeta is encircled by the girls and they walk off. Silka, head down, lags behind.
"My love."
Chapter 13.
That night, Lale lies on his bed, the happiest he's been for as long as he can remember. In her own bed, Geeta lies curled up next to a sleeping Dana, her eyes wide open staring into the darkness, reliving the moments she lay with Lale. His kisses, the longing her body felt for him to continue, to go further.
Her face grows hot as fantasies of their next encounter play out in her mind. In a grand four-poster bed, Schwarzhuber and Silka lie in each other's arms. His hands explore her body as she stirs into nothing, feeling nothing, numb. In his private dining room at Auschwitz, Hoess sits at an elegant table for one. Fine food rests on fine china. He pours 1932 Chateau Latour into a crystal goblet. He swirls, sniffs, tastes the wine. He won't let the stresses and strains of his job impede life's little luxuries. A drunken Beretsky stumbles into his room in the barracks at Auschwitz. Kicking the door shut, he staggers and falls awkwardly onto his bed. With difficulty, he removes the belt holding his sidearm and slings it over the bedpost. Sprawled on his bed, he registers the overhead light still on, shining into his eyes. After an unsuccessful attempt to get up, he locates his weapon with a clumsy arm and pulls it from its holster. With his second shot, he kills the recalcitrant light bulb. His gun drops to the floor as he passes out.
The next morning, Lale winks at Geeta as he collects his supplies and instructions from Bella in the administration office.
His smile disappears when he notices Silka sitting beside Geeta, her head down, once again not acknowledging him.
"This has been going on far too long."
He resolves to force Geeta to tell him what is wrong with Silka. Outside, he is met with a very hungover, angry Beretsky.
"Hurry up! I've got a truck waiting to take us to Auschwitz."
Lale follows him to the truck. Beretsky climbs into the cab, shutting the door. Lale gets the message and scrambles into the back. There, he endures the trip to Auschwitz, tossed from one side to the other. When they arrive at Auschwitz, Baretsky tells Lale that he is going to lie down, and that Lale is to make his way to Block 10. Once he finds the block, Lale is directed around the back by the SS officer standing out front. Lale notices that it looks different to the blocks back at Birkenau.
The first thing he sees as he rounds the corner of the building is the wire fence that encloses part of the backyard. Slowly, he registers small movements in the enclosed area. He stumbles forward, transfixed at what lies beyond the fence. Girls. Dozens of them. Naked. Many lying down. Some sitting. Some standing. Hardly any of them moving. Paralyzed.
Lale watches as a guard comes into the enclosure and walks through the girls, picking up their left arms, looking for a number, one possibly made by Lale. Finding the girl he wants, the guard drags her through the bodies. Lale looks at the girls' faces, vacant, silent.
He notices several leaning against the wire fence. Unlike the other fences at Auschwitz and Birkenau, this one is not electrified. The option of self-destruction has been taken from them.
Who are you?
A voice behind him demands.
Lale turns. An SS officer has come out from a back door. Slowly Lale holds up his bag.
Tetoviera.
So what are you standing out here for? Get inside.
One or two of the doctors and nurses in white coats greet him as he walks through a large room towards a desk. The prisoners here don't look like people. More like marionettes abandoned by their puppeteers. He approaches the nurse sitting behind the desk and holds up his bag.
Tetoviera.
She looks at him with disgust, sneers, stands and walks off. He follows her. She leads him down a long corridor and into a large room. About 50 young girls stand there in a line, silent. The room smells sour. At the front of the line, Mengele is examining one of the girls. Roughly opening her mouth, grasping her hips, then her breasts, as tears fall silently down her face. Finishing his examination, he waves her off to the left. Rejected. Another girl is pushed into her vacated place.
The nurse walks Lale up to Mengele, who stops his examination.
You are late,
he says with a smirk, clearly enjoying Lale's discomfort. He indicates a small group of girls standing to his left.
Those I am keeping. To their numbers.
Lale moves off.
One day soon, Tetoviera, I will take you.
Lale looks back, and there it is. That tight pull of the lips that constitutes a sick smile. Once again a chill spreads throughout his body. His hands shake. Lale picks up his pace, hurrying to a small table where another nurse sits with identification cards at the ready.
She makes room for him to set up. He tries to control the shaking in his hands as he lines up his tools and ink bottles. He looks over at Mengele, who has another frightened girl in front of him, and is running his hands over her hair and down her breasts.
Don't be frightened. I'm not going to hurt you.
Lale hears him tell her. Lale watches the girl shiver in fear.
There, there. You're safe. This is a hospital. We take care of people here.
Mengele turns to a nearby nurse.
Get a blanket for this pretty young thing.
Turning back to the girl, he says,
I'll take good care of you.
The girl is sent in Lale's direction. Lale puts his head down and prepares to get into the rhythm of tattooing the numbers shown to him by the nurse assisting. When his work is complete, Lale leaves the building and looks again into the fenced area. It is empty.
He drops to his knees and dry retches. He has nothing to bring up. The only fluid in his body is tears. That night, Geeta returns to her block to learn that there are several new arrivals. The established residents eye the newcomers with resentment. They don't want to have to talk about the horrors that lie in store, nor share their rations.
Geeta. Is that you, Geeta?
A feeble voice calls out. Geeta approaches a group of women, many of whom seem older. Older women are rarely seen in Birkenau, which is home to the young who can work. A woman steps forward, her arms outstretched.
Geeta, it's me, your neighbor, Hilda Goldstein.
Geeta stares and suddenly recognizes a neighbor from her hometown of Vranov nad Tuplu, paler and thinner than when Geeta saw her last. Memories flood Geeta, scents and textures and flashes of the past. A familiar doorway, the aroma of chicken soup, a cracked bar of soap by the kitchen sink, happy voices on warm summer nights, her mother's arms.
Mrs. Goldstein.
Geeta moves closer, clasps the woman's hand.
They took you too.
The woman nods.
They took us all away maybe a week ago. I got separated from the others and put on a train.
A rush of hope.
My parents and sisters are with you? No. They took them several months ago. Your parents and your sisters. Your brothers have been gone for a long time. Your mother said they joined the resistance. Do you know where they were taken?
Mrs. Goldstein drops her head.
I'm sorry. We were told they were...
Geeta crumbles to the floor as Dana and Ivana rush to her, sit on the ground and embrace her. Above them, Mrs. Goldstein continues to speak.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Both Dana and Ivana are crying, holding the dry-eyed Geeta. They babble words of condolence at Geeta. Gone. No memories come now. She feels a terrible emptiness inside her. She turns to her friends and asks in a halting, broken voice,
Do you think maybe it's okay for me to cry just a little bit? Do you want us to pray with you?
Asks Dana.
No, just a few tears. That's all I'll let these murderers have from me.
Ivana and Dana both wipe their own tears with the backs of their sleeves as silent tears begin to roll down Geeta's face. They take turns wiping them away. Finding a strength she didn't know she possessed, Geeta stands and embraces Mrs. Goldstein. Around her she can feel the recognition of those witnessing her moment of grief. They look on in silence, each going into their own dark place of despair, not knowing what has become of their own families. Slowly, the two groups of women, the long-termers and the newcomers, join together. After supper, Geeta sits with Mrs. Goldstein, who brings her up to date with events back home. How slowly, family by family was torn apart. Stories had filtered back about the concentration camps. No one quite knew that they had been turned into production lines of death. But they knew people were not coming back. And yet only a few had left their homes to seek a safe haven in a neighboring country. It becomes obvious to Geeta that Mrs. Goldstein will not survive long if she is made to labor here. She is older than her years. Physically and emotionally broken.
The next morning, Gita approaches the capo to ask for a favor. She will ask Lale to try to get the capo anything she wants if Mrs. Goldstein can be spared hard work and spend the day in the block.
She suggests that Mrs. Goldstein empty the toilet buckets each night, a task usually given to a person chosen each day by the capo, often someone she believes has spoken badly of her.
The capo's price is a diamond ring. She's heard the rumors of Lale's treasure chest. The deal is struck. For the next several weeks, Lale goes to Auschwitz every day. The five crematoria are working to full capacity, but large numbers of prisoners still have to be tattooed.
He receives his instructions and supplies from the administration building at Auschwitz. He has no time and no need to go to the administration building at Birkenau, so he has no opportunity to see Gita. He wants to get a message to her that he is safe.
Baretsky is in a good, even playful mood. He has a secret, and he wants Lale to guess what it might be. Lale plays Baretsky's juvenile game.
You're letting us all go home?
Baretsky laughs and punches Lale on the arm.
You've been promoted.
You'd better hope not, Tito Vieira. Otherwise, someone not as nice as me will end up minding you.
Okay, I give up.
I'll tell you then. You're all going to be given extra rations and blankets next week for a few days. The Red Cross are coming to inspect your holiday camp.
Lale thinks hard. What can this mean? Will the outside world finally see what is happening here? He works to keep his emotions in check in front of Baretsky.
That will be nice. Do you think this camp will pass the humanitarian test of imprisonment?
Lale can see Baretsky's brain ticking over, almost hear the little clicks. He finds his lack of comprehension amusing, though he doesn't dare smile.
You would be well fed for the days they are here. Well, those of you we let them see.
So it will be a controlled visit?
Do you think we are stupid?
Baretsky laughs.
Lale lets that question pass.
Can I ask a favor?
You can ask, says Baretsky.
If I wrote a note to Gita telling her I'm okay and just busy at Auschwitz, will you get it to her?
I'll do better. I'll tell her myself.
Thank you.
Although Lale and a select group of prisoners do receive some extra rations for a few days, they soon dry up and Lale is unsure if the Red Cross ever did enter the camp. Baretsky is more than capable of making up the whole idea. Lale has to trust that his message to Gita will be conveyed, though he doesn't trust Baretsky to do that straightforwardly either.
He can only wait and hope that a Sunday, when he doesn't have to work, will arrive soon.
Finally, the day comes when Lale finishes work early. He races between the camps and gets to the Birkenau administration building just as the workers are leaving. Impatiently, he waits. Why does she have to be one of the last ones out today? At last she appears. Lale's heart leaps. He wastes no time grabbing her by the arm and taking her to the back of the building.
She trembles as he pushes her up against the wall.
I thought you were dead. I thought I'd never see you again.
She stammers. He runs his hands along her face.
Did you not get my message from Baretsky? No, I got no message from anyone.
Shh, it's okay, he says.
I've been at Auschwitz every day for weeks. I was so frightened. I know, but I'm here now, and I have something to say to you. What? First, let me kiss you.
They kiss, clutching, pressing passionately before she pushes him away.
What do you want to say? My beautiful Gita, you've bewitched me. I've fallen in love with you.
They feel like words he's waited all his life to say.
Why? Why would you say that? Look at me. I'm ugly, I'm dirty, my hair. I used to have lovely hair. I love your hair the way it is now. And I will love it the way it will be in the future.
but we have no future.
Lale holds her firmly around her waist, forces her to meet his gaze.
Yes, we do. There will be a tomorrow for us. On the night I arrived here, I made a vow to myself that I would survive this hell. We will survive, and make a life where we are free to kiss when we want to, make love when we want to.
Geeta blushes and turns away. He gently moves her face back to him.
To make love, wherever, whenever we want to. Do you hear me?
Geeta nods.
Do you believe me? I want to, but...
No buts.
Just believe me. Now you'd better get back to your block before your capo starts wandering.
As Lale begins to walk off, Geeta pulls him back and kisses him hard.
Breaking the kiss, he says,
Maybe I should stay away more often. Don't you dare,
she says, hitting him on the chest. That night, Ivana and Dana pepper Geeta with questions, relieved to see their friend smiling again.
Did you tell him about your family?
Says Dana.
No. Why not? I can't. It's too painful to talk about. And he was so happy to see me. Geeta, if he loves you as he says he does... He would want to know you have lost your family. He would want to comfort you. You might be right, Dana. But if I tell him, then we'll both be sad. I want our time together to be different. I want to forget where I am and what's happened to my family. And when he holds me in his arms, I do forget. Just for those few brief moments. Is it wrong of me to want to escape reality for a bit? No, not at all. I'm sorry that I have my escape, my Lale. You know I wish with all my heart the same for you too. We are very happy that you have him,
says Ivana.
It's enough that one of us has a little happiness. We share in it, and you let us, that's enough for us,
says Dana.
Just don't keep any secrets from us, all right?
Says Ivana.
No secrets, says Geeta. No secrets,
agrees Dana. Chapter 14.
The next morning, Lale appears in the administration office and approaches Bella at the main desk.
Lale, where have you been?
Bella says with a warm smile.
We thought something had happened to you.
Auschwitz. Ah. Say no more. You must be low on supplies. Wait here, and I'll stock you up. Not too much, Bella.
Bella looks over at Geeta.
Of course. We need to make sure you come back tomorrow. You know me too well, young Bella. Thank you.
Bella wanders off to get his supplies, and Lale leans on the desk and stares at Geeta. He knows she has seen him come in, but is playing coy and keeping her head down. She runs a finger over her lips. Lale aches with desire.
He also notices that the chair next to her, Silka's, is empty. Again, he tells himself to find out what is happening with her. He leaves the office and heads over to the selection area, having already noted that a truck has arrived with new prisoners. As he is setting up his table, Baretsky appears.
I've got someone here to see you, Tetoviera.
Before Lale can look up, he hears a familiar voice, no more than a whisper.
Hello, Lale.
Leon stands beside Baretsky, pale, thinner, stooped over, carefully placing one foot in front of the other.
I'll leave you two to get reacquainted.
A smiling Baretsky walks off.
Leon. Oh my God, you're alive.
Lale rushes to embrace him. He can feel every bone through his friend's shirt. He holds him at arm's length, examining him.
Mengele? Was it Mengele?
Leon can only nod. Lale gently runs his hands down Leon's skinny arms, touches his face.
The bastard. One day he'll get his. As soon as I've finished here, I can get you plenty of food. Chocolate, sausage. What do you want? I'll fatten you up.
Leon smiles weakly at him.
Thanks, Lale.
I knew the bastard was starving prisoners. I thought he was only doing it to girls.
If only that was what it was.
What do you mean?
Now Leon stares directly into Lale's eyes.
You cut my fucking balls off, Lale.
He says, his voice strong and steady.
Somehow, you lose your appetite when they cut your balls off.
Lale reels back in horror and turns away, not wanting Leon to see his shock.
Leon fights back a sob and struggles to find his voice as he searches the ground for something to focus on.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said it like that. Thank you for your offer. I'm grateful to you.
Lale breathes deeply, trying to control his anger. He badly wants to lash out, to take revenge on the crime committed against his friend.
Leon clears his throat.
Any chance I can have my job back?
Lale's face floods with warmth.
Of course. Glad to have you back. But only when you've regained your strength,
he says.
Why don't you go back to my room? If any of the gypsies stop you, tell them you're my friend, and I've sent you there. You'll find supplies under my bed. I'll see you when I'm done here.
A senior SS officer approaches.
Go now, hurry.
Hurry is not something I can do right now.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm gone. See you later.
The officer watches Leon walk off and turns back to what he was doing previously, determining who should live and die.
The next day, Lale reports to the administration office to be told that he has the day off.
No transports are arriving at either Auschwitz or Birkenau, and there is no request from Herr Doktor to assist him. He spends the morning with Leon. He'd bribed his old capo in Block 7 to take Leon in, on the understanding he will work for him when he has regained his strength. He gives him food that he had been planning to give to his Romani friends and to Gita for distribution.
As Lale is leaving Leon, Beretsky calls out to him.
Tatar Viera, where have you been? I've been looking for you.
I was told I had the day off.
Well, you don't anymore. Come, we have a job.
I have to get my bag.
You don't need your tools for this job. Come.
Lale hurries after Beretsky. They are heading towards one of the crematoria.
He catches up with him.
Where are we going?
Are you worried?
Beretsky laughs.
Would you be?
No.
Lale's chest tightens. His breath comes too short. Should he run?
If he does, Beretsky will surely turn his weapon on him. But then what would it matter? A bullet is surely preferable to the ovens.
They are very close to Crematorium 3. Before Beretsky decides to put Lale out of his misery, he slows his long strides.
Don't worry. Now come on before we both get into trouble and end up in the ovens.
You're not going to get rid of me?
Not just yet. There are two prisoners in here who appear to have the same number. We need you to look at them. It must have been you or that eunuch who made the marks. You have to tell us which one is which.
The red brick building looms in front of them. Large windows disguise the purpose, but the size of the chimneys confirms its horrifying true nature.
They are met at the entrance by two SS, who joke with Beretsky and ignore Lale. They point to closed doors inside the building, and Beretsky and Lale walk towards them. Lale looks around at this final stretch of the road to death at Birkenau.
He sees the Sonderkommandos standing by, defeated, ready to do a job no one on Earth would volunteer for. Removing corpses from the gas chambers and putting them into the ovens.
He tries to make eye contact with them, to let them know he too works for the enemy. He too has chosen to stay alive.